morning. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to the first edition of Vantage Point in the new year 2017. And we do wish you a happy new year, and we hope that we're in for, well, it's going to be a resistance-filled year. It has to be if you're on the progressive side, but hopefully we are equipped and ready to go. And belated Haitian Independence Day, because January 1st is not only Emancipation Day in the African-American community, because on January 1st, 1863, Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, but it was in January 1st, 1804, that Jean-Jacques Dessalines declared Haiti the first black republic in the world, actually, after one of the greatest victories and one of the greatest triumphs in human history, the Haitian Revolution, which again produced the world's first black republic. And we'll be talking about that during the course of our show today. I want to also just remind people, just heard the announcement again, we continue to stress the need to become a WBAI buddy. Become a WBAI buddy. And that is by donating a tax-deductible donation for as little as $10 a month. You become a WBAI buddy, a sustaining contributor, if you will. But you can give more. I give more than $10 because, you know, I'm able to squeeze it out. I am a WBAI buddy. And that's a part of the station's strategy for building a strong, sustained base of support. It is a similar strategy that we're using with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. If you have a steady base like that, you kind of know what's happening. It's predictable and so forth. So we ask you to go to give to WBAI on the Internet, give to WBAI, and sign up to become a WBAI buddy. Well, today's show is going to begin shortly with Reverend Dr. Leon Pamphile. We're going to be talking about his book, Haitians and African Americans, A Heritage of Tragedy and Hope. We hope to be joined at 10:30 by the Honorable Judge Lionel Jean-Baptiste. There is a Lionel Pressois whom you've heard on the air. To talk about his organization and the current situation in Haiti, actually. There's just been a recently completed election. Things are somewhat in flux. We want to talk about that because we want to devote a significant amount of time to discussing Haiti today. Then at 11 o'clock, we're going to hear from none other than Tamika Mallory, who is a former executive director of the National Action Network, now has her own consulting business and does a tremendous amount of work with Justice League. But also is one of the key organizers for the major women's march on Washington on January 21st. We want to give some airing to that, obviously. And then at the bottom of the hour, we are going to throw the phones open to you in order to have you share your opinions. It's a pattern I want to establish where we at least give the audience the last 20 minutes to interact and to discuss with us. And in fact, we're having some difficulty connecting this morning with the Honorable Judge Lionel Jean-Baptiste, and if we don't reach him, we will open the phones a little earlier in order to have you become involved in the conversation. So, in fact, it looks like I'm hearing from Lionel Baptiste now. Okay, yeah, we'll get him. All right, so we now want to go to our first guest for today. Reverend Dr. Leon Pamphile. Reverend Pamphile, welcome to Vantage Point.
So much. Happy New Year to you.
Well, happy New Year to you and to your wife and all. We're delighted to have you join us this morning. And we want to start off by having you talk a little bit about your background. I didn't sort of read a full resume, and we don't need to have a full resume. We know that you've done this incredible book that I love so much. I've bought a number of them and have shared them as gifts to friends, both Haitian American and African American, for that matter, African American mostly. You also have the Functional Literacy Ministries, so you do humanitarian work in Haiti. But there's much more. You published several books. You are an academician and scholar par excellence. So give us a little bit about your background.
Thank you. It's an opportunity to share my background.
I am a proud Haitian. Was born and educated in Haiti and came to the United States in the early 70s. After my education, I recognize that I have a great debt toward Haiti, my native nation. So that's when I established now for 34 years the Functional Literacy Ministry of Haiti, which is an organization geared toward community development. We started by literacy and understanding that education is the real background for development. And we continued with other programs for community development, like a clinic, and we are operating a technical school, equipping young people and enabling them to find jobs or to engage in entrepreneurship. As a scholar, I am happy I was able to first write on it, the connection or the impact of the American occupation on education in Haiti. So published in French as Education in Haiti on the American Occupation, and in America it's called Clash of Cultures. My latest book, published last year in connection, really in already 2 years, in 2015, in connection with the centennial year of occupation of America, of the United States by Haiti. So it's called Contrary Destinies. And I am also currently a bishop for the Church of God in Christ in Haiti. I oversee some 100 churches and emphasizing spiritual empowerment at the spiritual level, but also making it important for pastors to know that they are an agent of development, and they have to provide education as much as possible and healthcare in their churches.
Very good. Well, Reverend Panfield, I really don't remember when I first came to know you, but I did come to know you by way of this great book that you wrote. I know you were involved with us. Have gone to Haiti with us at least a couple of times. In fact, you were with us on that great delegation that we put together just before the earthquake, which we had this incredible photo on the steps of the National Palace, where President Paul took us out, and we took that shot, and also cruising into history. So we've been connected for a while. But I want to know, why did you decide to write this book that's entitled Haitians and African Americans, A Heritage of Tragedy and Hope?
While studying at the seminary, that's when it started, way back in the early 70s, in my readings, I discovered during the colonial period that relationship between Haitians and African Americans. And I thought it was a great area of research, which has not been explored yet. And it probably took me from 71 all the way to 2001. I think that's probably over 30 years before I was able.
Decades of research. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. The book itself, it took me 12 years between rejection and correction and furthering the research. It took 12 years. I worked about 10 years in the University Press of Florida before I really published it. But what happened, beginning with that connection during the revolutionary period, then I came to discover that the relationship between Haitians and African Americans were not only at the political level or in the quest for freedom, but also it was immigration of African Americans to Haiti, and it continued in the area of religion. While in Haiti, they established churches. So that relationship is grounded on resistance, or resistance against oppression. It takes the form of armed resistance. But also, I continue to find out, but it was an intellectual resistance as well, that Haitian and African Americans, they fought against the dogma of the inner inferiority, you know, of black men. And it continues through the years in the 20th century with the American occupation of Haiti. So African Americans will rise to defend Haiti. And subsequently, people like Walter White, they wanted to see the economic development of Haiti. He worked very hard in this regard. And it went on all the way to the second half of the 20th century with immigration of Haitians to the United States. That's the multiple segment, and how African Americans, the Congressional Black Caucus, they stood up to defend Haiti. And it ended up with what you're doing today, with the closing to Haiti that we had. That was a great continuation, I believe, of the relationship between the two people. And I believe subsequently you also organized a trip to Haiti. So it's a very rich relationship between two people striving to stand up against oppression.
Now, the going back to sort of the immigration and some of the aspects, one, let me just go back to Henri Christophe. I understand that one of the leading members of his cabinet, I think maybe the Minister of Education or something, was an African-American. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, he worked with a very important African-American. Oh, the name doesn't come to me right now. But they have a very close relationship still for the purpose of the advancement of the struggle of the two people.
Now, also, was it James Theodore Holly? Which was it? It was one of the leading African-American church leaders. I think you may have referenced him. I don't know if it was Theodore Holly or not. I'm just taking this off the top of my head, or who also led and took people to Haiti and tried to establish, you know, and taking up Haiti's offer, by the way, then anybody who came would become a citizen. I think this is important to lay out in terms of the background, that Haiti became this beacon of hope and promise for enslaved Africans everywhere and those who were even quasi-free, like the, you know, people who really didn't have full freedom in this country. Haiti was the beacon of hope. And so African-Americans gravitated to Haiti. I've often referenced the fact that the slave revolt that was being planned in Charleston, South Carolina, that was the most elaborate of the slave revolts. The objective was to sail to Haiti. So there was this clear role that Haiti played in giving people, their sense of possibilities. And so talk to us. Was it James Theodore Holly? Is that the one who?
Yes, that's a good figure in the relationship between Haitians and African Americans. James Theodore Holly was an ardent proponent and defender of Haitian independence. Of course, he has that great lecture called Haiti's Vindication of the Capacity of the Black Man for Self-Government. And he articulately said that African Americans should go to Haiti and take with them the arts and science and genius of modern civilization to advance Haitian independence. And of course, Holly did go to Haiti and with a group of 113 people. It's a heroic story, very dramatic story. His wife died in Haiti, his son, but did not give up. He returned to the United States, get married, and went back to Haiti. Of course, he established the Episcopal Church in Haiti, which is still a great institution of Haitian society. And Holly did establish schools, started from scratch, and left a great legacy of school, hospital. Today, Hospital St. Croix in Léogâne, all that is part of the Episcopal Church. And two important facts to mention about Holly. It's a personality that really excites me. He became the first Episcopal Black bishop, because when he established his church in Haiti, the Episcopal Church recognized his work and named him as bishop. So that's the first African-American bishop of the Episcopal Church. And Holly became a Haitian citizen. He lived and died in Haiti. And also his children, he trained them. Some of them became doctors to continue his work in Haiti. It's a fabulous story.
Right, right. Well, also, talk to us about Frederick Douglass. He was someone who also championed Haiti very, very strongly.
Frederick Douglass is another great name in connection with the relationship between Haiti and the United States. Frederick Douglass said that
There is a question or a matter of racial identity that connects Haitian with African Americans. And he was, as you know, an American diplomat in Haiti. He stood and remained at the forefront of those who defended Haiti. For example, he said, whatever may happen of peace and war, Haiti will remain in the firmament of nations, and like the star of the north, will shine on and shine on forever. And he defended those who criticized the Haitians for its Latin connection. And Douglas said, if as is alleged, Haiti is more cordial to France than to the United States, it's because partly Haiti is herself French. A language is French, a literature is French, a manners and fashions are French, ambitions and aspirations are French, a laws and method of government are French. So to recognize the work of Douglas in Haiti, you know, when they have the World Fair, at the end of the 19th century, Douglas, he was the one that headed. Haitian delegation. So he's a great figure in the defense of Haitian independence.
Well, earlier you mentioned the name of Walter White, and our audience may not really be familiar with Walter White. Walter White was the first executive director of the NAACP. And people really may not be aware of the incredible role that the NAACP played for many, many years, standing up and defending Haiti. So talk to us a little bit more about Walter White and the role of the NAACP in its defending and standing up for Haiti.
Yes, it is a very important chapter in the struggle of Haitians and African Americans. For throughout the 19th century, Haiti was, if you want to say, the star in the sky of black people. Haiti was highly respected for being the defender or really being the first nation to gain its independence through armed struggle. So when Americans invaded Haiti in the in 1915, the NAACP really took a very important role in defending Haitian independence. So the NAACP at that time wanted to play a role not only in defending blacks in American society, but also
moving beyond the American borders into international forum. So they sent James Weldon Johnson to Haiti to investigate what happened there. And as a result of James Weldon Johnson investigation, we know that the Haitian situation was widely discussed in the American press, forcing the American government to really send a couple of commissions to go and investigate. And that was ultimately the beginning of the end of the American occupation. But Walter White, he played a great role also in that struggle. Walter White reminded African Americans that Haiti is a unique and outstanding demonstration in the Western Hemisphere of the Negro ability to govern himself and to administer its own affairs. So, along this line, not only he worked after the end of the occupation, he also worked to promote human rights and economic development in Haiti. You know, the period of 1946 and 1956 was probably the golden age of economic development in Haiti. Walter White played a great role in that development, because he worked with President Dumas Estime, and he also, at the end of Estime's government, he worked with President Magloire, Paul Magloire. And he also participated, he suggested in 1954 the celebration in grand fashion of the 150th anniversary of Dessalines' proclamation of Haiti as a free and independent government. At the economic level, White strongly supported Haiti's effort to secure a $30 million loan from the Export-Import Bank to pay off the balance of outstanding private loans, and also to fund necessary projects to develop Haiti's natural resources. So, White, I think this, that should be a suggestion for a good piece of research on the connection between of Walter White has done for Haiti. His wife, Poppy Cannon, you know, he was the one who established the first bureau in New York for the promotion of tourism in Haiti. So, one more thing.
Yeah, quickly, because we're running out of time.
You know what happened? Paul Magloire, he visited and spoke to the joint session of Congress because of the effort of Walter White.
Well, Dr. Pamphile, We really, really appreciate you coming on with us today. One day, of course, January 1st is Haitian Independence Day. This is January 2nd, but this is the closest opportunity I have with my show because we wanted to share with people this connection. I'm sure there are many, many Haitian Americans and African Americans who are unaware of this connection. And one of the things that we in the Haiti Support Project do is focus on building that relationship. That's our sort of the centerpiece of our work has been organizing and educating and organizing, mobilizing African Americans to play a respectful role in partnering with Haiti. In that regard, we hope we are following in the footsteps of people like Frederick Douglass and Walter White and others who have been along those trails, because we really believe, as you indicated earlier, that all people of African descent and all people of all human rights lovers owe a very special debt to Haiti for the Haitian Revolution that established the very first Black Republic in the world. So your book is an important book, an important contribution, and we're delighted you were able to come on with us this morning and to share its insights with our audience.
Thank you very much, and I want to encourage you into continuing to build or to keep open the bridge, the historical bridge between Haitians and African Americans. And I know you are committed to build a much potent constituency for Haiti in the United States to voice the interests and aspiration of the masses of the Haitian people. I want to encourage you in that great endeavor, and also to remind your audience that Haiti needs the support and the help to improve the welfare of its citizens. Thank you very much for having me.
Let me just finally ask you, is your book still available on Amazon? Can people still purchase the book?
Yes, they can purchase it on Amazon. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much, and best to your wife. We'll be in touch
very
soon.
Thank you, and best to your wife as well. Happy New Year.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, all right. That was Reverend Dr. Leon Pamphile talking about the unique relationship between Haitians and African Americans. The book is Haitians and African Americans, A Heritage of Tragedy and Hope. It is an incredible book. It was really eye-opening, and I've shared copies with many, many friends, both Haitian Americans and African Americans, members of the Congressional Black Caucus and various other folk, because it is a powerful testimony to an important Pan-African relationship. Coming up next will be the Honorable Judge Lionel Jean-Baptiste, continuing our discussion about Haiti and Haitian independence and the current situation in Haiti. This is Vantage Point. This is the first show in 2017. We're going to take a brief pause, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Ella Joyce, and when I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM. The more you listen, the more you learn.
This is the theme music for Cat Radio Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
A salon of the arts.
Uh-huh.
Mondays at 2 p.m. I'm Janet Coleman, the host.
And I'm David Dozer,
the displaced playwright.
Announcing
Cat Radio Cafe.
Cat Radio Cafe, featuring great interviews with scintillating authors and provocative artistes.
Or vice versa.
I see you, cats.
Hey.
Stop clawing the furniture. Head for the radio.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Mondays at 2 p.m. here on WBAI.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
If it's brewed with fish.
Building bridges your community and labor report. From your workplace to your neighborhood, listen to the show that brings it all together. Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash, bringing you news and analysis, local, national, and international. Monday nights, 7 p.m., we build bridges.
People are already comparing the upcoming Trump era to the 50s McCarthy era. On the next episode of Ken Gayle's Ecologic will be a discussion with people who were there. The 50s had the communist blacklist and attack on unions, but it also had Ban the Bomb and civil rights marches and the flourishing of political folk music. Join Corinne Willinger of the Raging Grannies, Viney Burroughs of the Granny Peace Brigade, and other elders who lived through the McCarthy era. Tuesday, January 3rd at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Tune in Wednesdays at 3 a.m. for From the Soundboard, a show that usually focuses on concerts regardless of musical style, where the artist and or group perfects the art of the call and response with its audience. Always different, never scared, and hosted by Reggie Johnson. That's Wednesdays at 3 a.m. for From the Soundboard, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org throughout planet Earth.
Okay, we're back, and again, continue our conversation about Haiti and its many manifestations. Really delightful conversation with Reverend Dr. Leon Pamphile, someone I came to meet and to learn a lot from in terms of this unique relationship between Haitians and African Americans. And again, his book can be found on Amazon, Haitians and African Americans, A Heritage of Tragedy and Hope. And of course, he's published other books as well and is deeply engaged in humanitarian and developmental work in Haiti as well. We're now joined by the Honorable Judge Lionel Jean-Baptiste, who is a longtime friend. I first met him through Dr. Conrad World as I was reflecting back on the relationship. Judge Lionel Baptiste, thank you for joining us this morning on Vantage Point. Judge Baptiste, are you there?
Happy New Year.
Oh, okay. Go right ahead.
Yes, hello.
I wasn't hearing you for a minute. Go right ahead.
Okay, I was saying thank you and Happy New Year to you and Happy New Year to your listening audience. It's a pleasure to be on the line with you, and we know we're on the same team, so that's an excellent thing.
Yeah, I was reflecting back, again, as I said in my introduction, meeting you first through our mutual friend, Dr. Conrad Wuerl. But I'd like for you to just share a brief bit about your background. You do incredible work around Haiti, but I didn't first meet you so much as a Haitian-American activist as someone who was deeply involved in the Black liberation struggle in Chicago and in various areas. So just give us a little bit about your background.
Well, you know, I came to the United States, you know, at 14 years old in the height of the civil rights movement, Black liberation movement. So I was fully integrated in everything that was going on, and brought with me my own understanding of Haitian history in Haiti. Going to school, you memorize your history. So you wear it on your chest, on the fact that you were the first Black nation to defeat European enslavers and liberated yourself, and then come to America in the midst of a lot of teaching that was going on. You didn't have to be in an organization at that time in the 60s and 70s to be exposed to so much information. And I was in, when I was in high school, you know, the Panthers were doing their work in our community. I went to high school in the city of Evanston, where Northwestern was. At that time, people like Wayne Watson, the brother who was in charge of Africana studies at Cornell.
James Turner.
That's his name. Yeah, James Turner. A number of other activists were very close to the youth in the community, so they raised our consciousness. I went away to school and was there in a period of time when we were really trying to figure out, okay, what are we to do? I was a major in political science and Black studies, and we connected with the whole movement, African Liberation Support Movement, the struggle that was going on between black nationalists and black black Marxist-Leninists and others, and came out of Princeton, moved to Brooklyn, where I connected directly with, you know, some frontline folks like Viola Plummer and others. African Liberation Support Committee was on the front page. Owusu Sodoki and others at that time were spokespeople for the movement, and also connected with the Puerto Rican independence folks. And, you know, reconnected with the anti-repression, anti-dictatorship movement in Haiti, where there was a radio program on Columbia called Le Haitien, the Haitian Hour. His brother, Lionel Le Wolf, did a lot of teaching, a lot of connecting and stuff. And so the work continued, and, you know, I engaged in all facets of the work. And luckily, I was not, my brain was open enough to integrate the many currents in our African liberation struggle and people's liberation struggle, anti-war movement and others, to be able to understand the interconnection and interdependence of all those struggles. So, you know, when by the time I returned to Chicago, I had been exposed to a lot of stuff, and I was at Malcolm X College working when I connected with Dr. Conrad Worrell and others. And, you know, the school, we turned into a resource for the community to do its work. Dr. Conrad Worrell, at that time with Dr. Carruthers, was dealing with African-centered studies, curriculum, fighting for that kind of stuff. And we, you know, basically continued to do our work. So that's where we're at. And in terms of the evolution of our own work, specific work in the Haitian community, you know, looking around trying to connect with the best way to make our contribution, we had summed up, some of us, that part of Haiti's significant weakness is depopulation. It's lost a lot of people, significant folks, as a result of the dictatorship. Many of us were scattered throughout the world for one reason or another. Some were political folks who left seeking asylum, or left on their own accord because they knew that they faced high risk. But the dictatorship, the Duvalier dictatorship from 1957 to 1986, really scattered a lot of people all over the place and created in the Haitian diaspora, created a Haitian diaspora that was active. And so my only regret is that the activism that we engaged in over that period of time didn't create an ANC, didn't create permanent organizational infrastructures for those of us who became of age towards, you know, in the midst of that movement, and didn't leave the activists interconnected in an organizational way. So post-86, many of us were involved in the what is called the 10th Department, because Haiti at that time had 9 geographical departments, so we declared ourselves the 10th Department. Jean-Baptiste Aristide promoted that, and so we began to organize. But even then, the organizational framework was not one that was strong, consistent, rooted in traditional organizational methodology, loyalty, lines, principles, regulations. So it was a bunch of activists, people dedicated, people passionate for the struggle who were getting together and holding together. So it didn't last long. People scattered over differences that may not even have been ideological, it may have been personal. And they sought to continue to do individual work. But coming back to Chicago after after New York, I returned about 84, and many folks knew that I was affiliated with a number of people who at that time faced persecution, legal persecution under Giuliani. And I was one of the grand jury resistors at that time. But coming back, I'd gone to law school, and afterwards decided to, in the Haitian community, we summed up that we needed to form an organization that sought to mobilize Haitians living in the diaspora, our friends, our allies, and our children, to try to help redevelop Haiti, try to help to shore it up externally and internally, and to fight to reintegrate. And so we, when our first campaign was to
hello?
The Constitution, sorry about that.
Oh, okay.
The Constitution of
that was, when you say we, is we what is that we is we now an organization?
Yeah, Haitian Americans. Yeah, the Haitian Congress to Fortify Haiti.
Okay,
we formed the Haitian Congress to Fortify Haiti.
Right, you just had right to say around that, so the, I just wanted to bring that out. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was in the midst of we were. It was in 2004 when you were trying to organize. The return, African-Americans mobilizing folks to return to help celebrate 200 years anniversary of independence. We, too, were preparing to celebrate that moment when Hurricane Jean hit us, killing about 3,000 people in Gonaïves. And we were also confronted with the fact that there was another coup d'etat in Haiti. President Aristide was overthrown. So, you know, although we were very partisan, you know, our political spirits were totally inflamed in terms of what was going on and the pros and cons debate. But we were also facing a natural tragedy where 3,000 of our people had died in a hurricane in Gonaïves, Hurricane Jean. So we pulled ourselves together as an organization to confront the lines that bounded us, which was the human tragedies, the need of the country, and thereafter officially build the Haitian Congress to Fortify Haiti on the basis of the need to reintegrate the diaspora, the need to mobilize it. And so we fought our first major campaign as an organization, which ran the course of almost 7 years, to amend the Constitution, because even though our current constitution was rewritten, refounded in 1987 after Duvalier was thrown out. The reality is the activists were still very narrow thinking people, because they said if you had left the country and you stayed out for 3 years, if you became the citizen of another nation, you were no longer Haitian. And so that had a lot of implications in terms of the extent to which you could participate. There were certain rights that were limited. So we stood up and fought that campaign, and we won the amendment in two sessions. The Haitian Constitution is very complicated. So we had to, you know, win the recommendations under, at that time, under Préval. And subsequently, we won the final approval under Martin Lee when he first came to power. It's the last legislative session of the outgoing legislation and the first legislative session that had to approve it. So Préval was very instrumental in setting the atmosphere. And because we are fraught with instability in Haiti, the legislature doesn't always survive to the end of its of the term of the presidency all the time. So we were the stars were lined up. We worked hard. The internal allies were ready to work with us. And so almost unanimously at both legislatures, the 48th and the 49th, voted to grant us the amendment. And so once we've done that, it also went beyond that particular point and also called for granted citizenship to all Haitians, all individuals born of a Haitian mother or a Haitian father, wherever you're born. So our children being born in the diaspora were also are also Haitians. So our fight right now is the continued fight for reintegration. We have gone, as the Haitian Congress of Fortify Haiti, we have formed alliances and continued to associate with various organizations, because even winning that campaign was a product of affiliation, relationship, building coalition with other entities. So today, our work is primarily under the banner of the United Front of the Haitian Diaspora, which has 10 points of unity. And we try to unite as many people as we can around some specific set of principles. And we call for, you know, the unity of those who are willing to fight together, to come together, because we Haitians can, we will sit down, we'll talk, and we may not be willing to do the work, but we want to be in to be able to engage in all kinds of stuff. So we try to give people things to do. And some of those principles include, if we have time, include, you know, the issue of anti-discrimination against Haitians who live outside the country and who live in the outskirts, the peasantry, the poor, et cetera, et cetera, especially around the issue of the right to vote. We are demanding the right to vote as Haitians in the diaspora. Although we have it constitutionally, we're also demanding that they put the put in place a wherewithal for us to do so in the embassies and the consulates. The right to representation at the level of, at all levels of society, parliament, and others. The right to also, we are trying to fight around the issue of the remittance that we send. We send $500 million a day to Haiti.
Wow.
It translates into $2 billion per year.
$2 billion, that's right.
Yeah, $2 billion per year. We took the $2 billion divided by 365, and it's $500 million. So that means there's a lot of money going in. But much of that money is being spent in goods that are imported from the Dominican Republic, goods that are imported from the United States. And so we are trying to advocate buy Haitian-made products, buy purchase Haitian services with that remittance. We're also talking about budgeting, because what happens in Haiti is that budgeting is done on a national level, plus we pay. We rely on the international community for 60 to 70% of our budget. You can't do self-determination with that kind of reliance.
Right.
So we call for more self-determining budgeting, sustainable budgeting. And we're also talking about decentralization of the process of budgeting, because the towns, the municipalities, Jacques Mel doesn't do its own budgeting. Cap Haïtien doesn't do its own budgeting. So you, depending on the largest of the central government to trickle down something to you, when that means your own population is not being put in motion, is not being engaged. And so, and we think that the more that is done, the more people will be ready to meet their own needs and obstacles. In the United States, every governmental entity does budgeting. So we think that you've got to decentralize it, and it will decentralize the nation itself in the process, because we're very centralized. We call Haiti the Republic of Port-au-Prince. That's where everything happens.
Right.
We're also calling for empowerment in the United States and in throughout the diaspora, because we know that right now we have about 40 Haitian American elected officials and ex-elected officials. So we're calling for engagement so that our tax dollars that we're paying as Americans or as French Haitians or whatever, that we can influence the redistribution of those, the grants that go to Haiti in a way that is helpful to our interests. And plus, Haitian Americans constitute significant percentage of populations, such as in Florida and New York, Boston, and other places. So we've got to raise our voices where we are. Dip your bucket where you are, as Booker T would say. So there are a number of issues that we've raised in the process. And we also call for continued education of our people to transfer culture, language, and custom to our youth in the diaspora, meaning try to fight for Saturday schools, try to do different things, celebrate all of our events, all our national events. Yesterday was Haitian Independence Day. So we're promoting that everywhere where people are at, you've got to celebrate your events to transfer the information, to remember, and to maintain solidarity. So there are a number of other points of unity that we have pulled together to work around, to do the work. So we've got people in France. There's a sister in the Congo. We've got folks in Jamaica, in Dominican Republic, and throughout the United States, Florida, New York, Atlanta, Chicago area, of course. So it's a international effort. But as you know, the fight to organize and to stay, sustain and to maintain organization is extraordinary. And we have to try to professionalize our organization so we could find a way to be sustainable and long enduring. So
I wanted to conclude, because we're running out of time, Ashley. I wanted to conclude on two points. One, you, at least your organization helped, well, along with other organizations, this United Front, helped to lead an effort to make the most recent Haitian elections. By that I mean to help finance them, to not rely so much on international agencies and so forth. So would you spend a minute on that as a, one of the self-determining expressions of the work?
Yeah. Well, what happened is that because the elections of 2015, we've been in the election for 2 years now. 2015 had, there were a lot of questions. So that election last August 24th, people didn't find that election to have been correct. So there was a call for verification that concluded there was a lot of fraud. And so they decided not to proceed to the second phase of the election, but to redo it altogether. So the United States, France, Canada, and others who had financed that election at $78 million, although much of their surrogates were the ones who got the money. The reality is they took a position that we are not going to finance a redo. So you're on your own. So on that note, Haitians all over the place said, hell yes, okay. You say you're not going to finance it. Let's seize the moment and be self-determining in this exercise of our own democracy. So people mobilized, and last August, we had a delegation that went to Haiti, met with President Prévert and many of the legislatures and legislators, and said that we are on board and we were willing to work to try to help raise necessary funds to help with the election. So we did that, and we also sent a delegation to Haiti to observe the last election on November 20th. So President Prévert was able to find the $55 million that was the cost of this latest election conducted in the midst of, you know, of course, the Hurricane Matthew, the aftermath, and some other natural disasters. And our observation team, we trained We spent some time interfacing with the council, provisional council for election in Haiti, who were clear folks, you know, and we were very satisfied with what we observed. And of course, in Haiti, folks don't lose easily. So the election took place, and Jovenel Moïse, who was better organized than the opposition, was able to prevail, and with 54-point-something% of the vote in the first round, he was declared the winner of the first round, but finalization had to undergo a process of review, a process of legal protest, and of course street protest. So they were supposed to announce the final results after all of the legal protests were settled on the 29th of December, but it was postponed to tomorrow. So we all are waiting to get the final word as to whether or not Jovenel is in fact declared the president or whether we're going to go into a phase two. My inclination is that we're not going to go into a phase two, you know, because some of the protests were not significant enough to change the significant gap that exists between the winner and the second place runner up. That's what's
right.
going
it's
on.
Huge, it's a huge gap. I mean, it's almost it's unusual for a candidate in the first round to come out with 55%, and the next candidate was almost like maybe 20%. It's a huge gap.
Yeah,
there.
20%. Right, yeah. Right. It is a very huge gap. But there was one thing that was going on with Jovenel being the choice of Marte Lee. Jovenel also had put in significant resources. Jovenel had accumulated a lot of money as a businessman, selling homegrown banana throughout various parts of the world, in Germany in particular. But they've been able to solicit the assistance or retain the services of professional election organizers, an international team that participated in the process. And they were pretty systematic. Usually Stan, who got second place, my opinion, you know, could have done differently because when they protested last August 24th, he was in second place and had the possibility of mobilizing and perhaps negotiating with those others who lost. At that time, Jovenel had about 32%. Or something, and Jusselistan had another 20% again. But I don't know, the kind of campaign that he ran may not have been a great campaign to mobilize enough people. And the reality is the opposition is made up of a lot of portions of the Lavalas movement that we knew post that brought Aristide to power.
Right.
Not only Jude inherited a portion of it, Mr. Seyan, Attorney Seyan, inherited a portion. Of course, Maurice Narcisse, who was Aristide's candidate, but also Maurice Jean-Charles Petit Dessalines. He was, you know, an inheritor of you know, the Lavalas movement. So they broke up that movement.
Right.
This was happening at this particular point in time. So my hope and wish is that we would stabilize the situation and engage in governance of the nation.
Right.
So we can make progress.
Right.
And as you and I have talked about, a government of national, you know, reconciliation,
of
national unity.
National inclusion. Look, Lionel,
yeah.
Judge, I've got to move on. I'm beyond my time. Got another guest waiting in the wings here. But really, we appreciate
wow.
you giving background on your organization, tremendous work that's being done, and some commentary on the election. We will have more conversations about it. I do have an article out on what I call Towards a Government of National Inclusion, which I promised to do and sent to you. So we'll keep working together.
I thought, and it's excellent. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Forward effort, backwards never, my friend. Take care.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief pause and come back because we have another guest waiting in the wings, we're going to come right back after we take this brief pause. And Tamika Mallory will join us after the break. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Smokey Robinson, and you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York.
Let the music take your mind.
I am Jeff Brady, host of In Other News. Join me on Monday, January 2nd, 2017 at 4 p.m. for a live two-hour interview with returning guest Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal, a story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal. The interview will be held at the Brooklyn Commons, located 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. It will also be broadcast live on WBAI 99.5 FM. We'll talk about Nick Bryant's research in exposing how pedophile networks are funded and covered up at the highest levels of government in the context of the rise of citizen journalism reporting on Pizzagate. Even though massive resources have poured into censoring so-called fake news, that's Monday, January 2nd, 2017 at 4 p.m. with Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal, live at the Brooklyn Commons, and simulcast on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. See you there.
It only happens once a week. Monday evenings at midnight.
I wish they'd hurry up with that transmission. I want to go to bed. I suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
Here on listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM, the name of the show, Night Shift, Monday nights, midnight.
Midnight.
Midnight. Here. On WBAI.
Okay, we're back, running a little bit behind time, but again, we devoted most of our show today to Haiti. Yesterday, January 1st, is not only Emancipation Day for African Americans, but it's Haitian Independence Day. And anybody who knows Ron Daniels and the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, Haiti Support Project, knows the tremendous passion we have for Haiti. So it was important that we devoted time to that. And of course, Reverend Dr. Leon Pamphile, with again his book, Haiti and African Americans, A Heritage of Tragedy and Hope. And of course, the Honorable Judge Lionel Jean-Baptiste is talking about the Haitian Congress to Fortify Haiti and incredible work that they're doing, including commentary on the most recent election. So we went a little long, but we hope it was worthwhile. And we apologize to our next guest for waiting patiently for us. Of course, she's been to Haiti with us and had a taste of what going to Haiti with the Haiti Support Project is all about. We welcome now the dynamic visionary, one of the great leaders in the nation today, Tamika Mallory. Tamika, Happy New Year and welcome to Vantage Point.
Happy New Year, and thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Daniels. You know, you are really like just such a great leader and inspiration for me, and I talk about you all the time, even though we don't see each other often.
Right, and again, we were talking about Haiti, and I remember you going to Haiti representing the National Action Network, did an incredible job seeing you going up to the Citadel, riding that horse, and it was one of the most interesting of our endeavors, because that's the first time we went up in such hazy weather and rain and all that. But you survived and did an excellent job. So we really, really enjoyed you being a part of the delegation. Well, Tamika,
I thank you for taking me on that trip. I often speak of it, and talk to folks. And whenever people come to me and tell me that they're going to donate large sums of money to some of the Red Cross and some of these big NGOs, I immediately stop them and give them, you know, information about the experience that I had in Haiti and the importance of really, donating to those local grassroots organizations that are doing real work on the ground. So thank you for that experience.
Right, and we will be continuing. Well, Tamika, I describe you as a young old soul, and I say that because from the first time I saw you, and everybody has seen this in you, just such young but mature and visionary and talented, without question. So, just give us a taste about your background. Where did all this come from? I've also had a chance to meet your parents and all that, but just where did all this stuff come from?
Well, listen, you hit it right on the head. You know, my parents were two of Reverend Sharpton's first members when he started National Action Network over 25 years ago. I am 36 years old, so therefore, you know, that means I basically grew up there in NAN, attending rallies and being a part of the activities. I was a youth leader. I used to sing the Black National Anthem to start our rally on Saturday morning. You know, the National Action Network still meets every Saturday. And I just grew up in the movement. I grew up around a lot of smart and passionate people, you know, Dr. Ben, and just the list goes on of those that I encountered, you know, over the years of being there at National Action Network. And I guess, you know, some of that wisdom I think I took on. And I guess, you know, somewhere around, first of all, my son is 17 years old. And when he was 2 years old, his father was shot and killed. He was left in a ditch, and he was dead for 2 weeks before his body was discovered. And at that time, you know, with all the pain and frustration and everything that I was dealing with, I think that all of what I had been hearing and what I had been learning began to kick in, and I started to own the movement for myself. And with that, you know, for the past 15 years, I've really dedicated my life, and it's actually been more than that in terms of how long I've been in it, but definitely for the last 15 years, I've dedicated my life to the liberation of Black people and the intersectionality of how our issues connect with other groups that are also struggling to succeed, you know. And so I guess that's the simple version, but there's a lot of stuff that has happened in between.
Right. Well, I think it's fair to say that, you know, your tenure as the executive director of the National Action Network was really fundamental to the organization spreading its, you know, its wings, its grasp, because it's always good to have someone who's talented and strong and has good administrative skills, good people skills to complement visionary leaders, because, you know, visionary leaders be visionary leaders, and they often need strong, capable, able people around them. And certainly we saw that in you and helping to build the National Action Network and to propel, you know, Reverend Al to the preeminent position that he holds now. So I think we all owe a debt of gratitude to you for that service. Now, you've moved on to do some other things. You've leaped into, in a very major way, the struggle around police brutality and accountability, and have played a role in that as well. I think through the Justice League. I may be mispronouncing it, but tell us about
your work. You're 100% right.
Talk to us about that work.
So I'm actually on the board of something called the Gathering for Justice, an organization that Harry Belafonte started over 10 years ago. And he and I actually served on the board together, which is the funniest thing. When I tell people that, they're like, really? And I say, yeah, but he's in charge. And so, and by him being in charge, the funny thing, and I know you can appreciate that, is that he's really quiet and he listens to us and allows us really to sort of shape the mission and vision for the organization. And whenever he has to speak, his questioning or his thoughts are so deep, it really channels our energy in a very, very, impactful way. And so through the Gathering for Justice, we have several initiatives. One of them is Justice League NYC. The executive director of the Gathering for Justice is a sister by the name of Carmen Perez. She's a Mexican-American young lady who has been working with Harry Belafonte for a long time. And she co-founded the Justice League NYC initiative, which it focuses on bringing people, and she really makes it simple. She says, I had a lot of dope friends doing a lot of great things that were pretty much, you know, all somewhere 45 and younger. And she wanted to bring that group of people together to really look at ways to build power. And when you look at Justice League, it is made up of folks who you don't necessarily see as sort of respected leaders in the movement. There are people who are formerly incarcerated, many of which participated in your conference just recently. My son Lennon, who did a 7-year bid, and before going into prison, he actually was on his way to becoming one of the greater rappers, hip hop artists of our time, and he was picked up in a lineup for a crime he didn't commit, and he ended up serving 7 years. And so his story about being on the track to stardom and then having it all taken away based upon a criminal justice system that is clearly unfair and unfit is a real story. And so he brings that perspective to the table and uses his art as an opportunity to engage younger people and folks who are not necessarily focused on the movement. And we get them in, bring them involved based upon that. You know, Linda Salsour, Muslim activist, Palestinian sister from Brooklyn, no joke, she's a member of Justice League NYC. You have Angelo Pinto, who works on the Raise the Age campaign, a young man who is trying his best to work on getting young people 16 and 17 years old out of adult prisons. And the list goes on with other young folks who are Ramin Amendeza. This brother does graphic work and also a videographer, a documentarian. And he brings his efforts to Justice League. So it's just an amazing group of younger people. And after the non-indictment of Daniel Pantaleo for choking Eric Garner to death, Justice League hit the streets in a big way. And we were organizing all of the shutdowns of bridges and just all kinds of stuff, and have been active since then. And then we marched from New York City to Washington, D.C., with three pieces of federal legislation that one of them has actually been passed, the other has been reintroduced, and the other has been reauthorized around juvenile justice, and all of them focusing on criminal justice reform. And so we have remained together as a group and continue to work towards ways that people, again, who have not necessarily been engaged in the movement can find entry points.
Oh, that's wonderful. Really, really. And as you said before, we really had a tremendous criminal justice track. Criminal injustice track. We really had, that was a central focal point of the recent State of the Black World Conference, ending the war on drugs and looking at all the different aspects of it. There were scores of people who were involved. And then Jaziri X had a whole section for hip-hop activists, and Paradise Gray couldn't come, but he helped to organize that. So it was really a robust kind of conversation. Now I want to turn my attention to the Women's March on Washington. really, really wanted to have some conversation about that, because we are in the era of Trump now, or as he was being called at the State of the Black World Conference, the Orange Man or whatever, which is really no joke, actually, given the seriousness of the situation we find ourselves in. But this promises to be perhaps the largest and most significant demonstration of them all. There's a lot of scattered things, and that's not a critique, but I'm just saying that's probably good that there's many, many different kind of protests. But this one seems to be taking on sort of a major, major life that may well be the most significant in terms of resistance, but also vision. So talk to us about its origins, how you got involved in it, what it'll look like, and how people can get engaged.
So thank you, you know, so much for, talking about this. I think one of the critical issues is that we want to make sure that Black folks and our intellectuals and all of those who are in the movement and even outside of the movement are focused on this moment and this the Women's March on Washington. The origins is that on November 9th, after the election, a woman by the name of Teresa in Hawaii sent out a invitation to 40 of her friends saying that she wanted to march in Washington, and she wanted them to join her because she was so devastated about the election. Of those 40 friends, people began to invite other folks, and the invitation made it into a popular group on Facebook that the group was very supportive of whatever. It has turned into a lot of different things and has received a lot of criticism as of late, but Pantsuit Nation became a place where this march grew because people began to connect in that network space and say, you know, I also have one woman, you know, wanted to have a pussy grabs back march. Another lady wanted to have a nasty woman march. And so they all began to coordinate, and somehow they found one another. And of course, all of these women were white women or are white women. And they found one another and decided that they were going to merge their efforts. And by the time Thursday came, they had tens of thousands of people who had signed up to say that they wanted to go to Washington, D.C. On Friday morning, which was also Veterans Day, I got a call from a friend who was connecting me and Carmen Perez to these folks who were working on the march, in which the first call they said, you know, we have this thing, we put it out, we knew that we would get some folks to march, but we had no idea that it would blow up. And at that point, it was over 100,000 people who had indicated on Facebook that they would like to attend the march. And so they said, you know, but we know we cannot have this march and not ensure that women of color are involved and that women of color help us set the agenda. And they asked whether or not we would join their effort. We met with them on Saturday after the march, and we sat down and talked about what does centering the voices of women of color look like. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges at that time, which was actually fixed, or not so much fixed, but it had, in fact, been corrected and addressed by Friday when we got the call, was that they started out with the name Million Women March. And that name, as we know, references a very historic time for Black women in this country, where in 1997, that march, a march called Million Women March, happened in Philadelphia, and in fact, the 20th anniversary is coming up this year, 2017. And so one of the first tasks that we had was to ensure that we apologize publicly. Once we agreed to be a part of this effort, you know, we suggested that there be a public apology and promotion of the 20th anniversary of the Million Women March by these women. And so that was done. The name of the march was changed to the Women's March on Washington, and we've had, you know, some folks who didn't necessarily love that name either, felt that that was further appropriation, but what we know is that over his, in, you know, throughout history, March on Washington has been used for many movements. Mm-hmm. And we think that it is only fair that women would also have an opportunity to have a women's march on Washington. For us, centering the voices of women of color didn't mean just put our pictures up on the website and voila. It meant that we had to have some tough conversations and bring some very critical points up. And so we started out talking about what white privilege looks like and how these women, if they would like, if they want to engage in what they call, you know, allyship, and they want to work with women of color and whatever, then they needed to reach out into the communities that they come from and ensure that women of color were included and that they also, in ways, some ways, take a step back and don't always talk and let women of color do some of the talking so that you could do some learning.
Right.
So that has been sort of the tone that has been set throughout this effort. Has not been easy, has not always worked, but we are working towards it. And as a result, we've been able to bring the NAACP on board. We've been able to bring the Black Women's Roundtable with Melanie Campbell of the National Coalition of Black Civic Participation on board. And many other groups, Black Girls Rock and others, have joined us to be a part of this effort. And so, again, I appreciate you bringing me on to talk about it, because the criticism was that we don't want to go to a white women's march. And I understand that criticism. But the only way to make sure that that is not, in fact, the case is that we make it a march for us as well, that we show up. And so that is what we intend to do on January 21st in Washington, D.C.
So give us a little bit of the, first of all, I really, really appreciate the principled way in which that's being done, because that's one of the key struggles we face within the progressive movement, frankly. And I'll come back to that in a minute, because this is often difficult, but this is where we're going to have to go. But give us the boilerplate, where, when, website, those kind of things, so our listening audience will be able to plug in.
So on January 21st, Saturday, January 21st, we will meet at 10 a.m. At Independence and 3rd Street Southwest in Washington, D.C., Independence and 3rd Street Southwest. And we will be there rallying and gathering until around 1 p.m., and at that time we will march. Mm-hmm. We have not released all of the details of the march route, but we will be marching after the rally. And folks can go to womensmarch.com, that's womensmarch.com, for more information. Within the next few days, we're going to be releasing sort of a unity and statement of purpose, some of the policy concepts, ideas, and sort of the framing of what this march means. And so I know a lot of folks have been hungry for that, and we have been working on it. And really making sure that our partners are working together to help us bring the real true meaning and purpose for us gathering on January 21st.
Well, that's wonderful, because I think that we really do need these kinds of united front efforts in this period. And certainly it was really mind-boggling that those who voted, and we have to continue to say that, because in reality, the Trump regime will be a minority regime. It did not win the popular vote. It lost it by nearly 3 million votes. And so even commentators, as I listen to them, don't keep bringing that up. They should. It's true that Trump won via the Electoral College, but Trumpism and all that it represents did not win. The view put forth, no matter how fragmentary and with whatever flaws, advanced by Hillary Clinton, carried the day in terms of the popular vote. But that's the reality, is we have Trump in the White House, or he will be in the White House very shortly. So the question becomes, how do we organize and mobilize? And the question of the centrality, and I was listening very carefully to how you articulated that. The voices, and not just being tokens, and then the picture here and a picture there, is, and the whole notion of discussion of white privilege is such a crucial conversation within the progressive movement itself. It is probably one of the reasons why the Bernie Sanders campaign did not quite have the legs that it could have because of this kind of, it's not a malevolent thing, it's not something that people necessarily intend, but it is one of the vestiges of kind of implicit bias or a kind of racism that's just embedded that people sometimes don't see. So that this approach, I think, is really important in terms of the way that, you know, you've laid it out and those of your allies have laid it out, because we, the voices of people of color, of African people of African descent and others, must be at the very center. And quite frankly, sometimes difficult for white progressives to take a little backseat a little bit. I mean, it's just we've experienced that as being difficult, but really appreciate the way you're approaching this.
Well, you know, that is 100% right. And we deal with that. You know, I've had to tell people, actually did an interview for Undefeated, and folks who want to pull it up, if they just search Undefeated and Tamika Mallory, they could find the article where I talk about the fact that this has not been easy for me. I've been conflicted every single day because I've had to stop several times in the planning of this effort to talk about white privilege, to point out some of the language that's being used, the idea of the All Lives Matter, I'm going to Washington for all lives. You know, no one struggle is more important than the other. You know, those are some of the comments that I've had to work on. But, you know, I was not going to allow women or a gathering to happen in Washington, D.C., where people say that they're talking about women and our voices were not centered, and that there was not a strong focus on black liberation, that there was not a strong focus on what it looks like to live in a society that abuses a people without any accountability at all. Could not be that there was an opportunity for folks to come up with what they think our agenda is, or to set an agenda and have it look as though whatever the white woman's agenda is the agenda for all of us. No, that could not be. We had to be there. And sometimes I know that there is not only a desire, but also people working very hard at building our own tables. But I think we also have a responsibility to stand in the middle of tables that have been built by others and ensure that our issues are being discussed, that we are also a part of those conversations. And so, you know, as I said, we would not allow this gathering to happen where we were not present. You know, and when I talk about Carmen Perez and Linda Sarsour being co-chairs of this event, along with Bob Bland, who was one of the initial founders, and I, you know, Linda, as a Muslim woman in this country, her people, her community is an imminent threat in this moment. And we know that as a Mexican-American, you know, she's looking at whether or not her family members will be deported. So we're dealing with very serious issues. And while reproductive rights is important to women, all women, while sexism is clearly an issue, but racism and hate and that oppression comes through and it wipes out communities of color, and we all know that. And so this is a moment for us to talk about it. And the other thing, you know, Dr. Daniels, and I'll stop, is that, you know, we're not going to Washington to protest Donald Trump. We are going to Washington because the president, the administration, new administration, as well as the Congress, as well as the Senate, as well as the Supreme Court, as well as local governments back at home, governors, district attorneys, they all need to be on notice that when women are unhappy, the nation cannot rest. And so we're not narrow focused, and we are more sophisticated than to think that Donald Trump is the only person that we need to be talking to. He is a symptom of a disease that existed long before, and we're going to Washington to address the whole.
Well, we appreciate that prescription, and we sure are going to need it in this period. And because sometimes out of the negative comes a positive, I see this as the last, well, I hope, the last dying gasp, really, grasp of white supremacy, because a new America must be born, and it's out of these kinds of struggles that America is going to be born, and it's going to be better and stronger than we can even imagine right now. But it takes sometimes, unfortunately and tragically, these kinds of difficult struggles for it to be born. but it can only be born out of the kind of frank, honest discussion, principled debate and discussion. It ain't touchy-feely. It ain't kumbaya, necessarily. Mm-mm. It's really these kinds of difficult discussions. And we appreciate you being at the center of that as the visionary, courageous leader that you are, and appreciate you so much spending some time with us on Vantage Point this morning. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to just make sure that folks know that there's some great women, no matter what color they are, some great women that are involved in organizing this effort, and I hope that people will support and feel welcome to join.
And it's womensmarch.com is the website to go to.
Womensmarch.com. Yes, okay. Womensmarch.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Tamika, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. That's the last of our interviews for the day. And we're going to come back and take your calls. And, of course, we do them one at a time, so we want you to be patient. But 347-335-0818. That 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818. We'll get you into the conversation. This is Vantage Point. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, and we'll come right back to your calls after this break.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Fried from Spearhead.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial peace and justice radio in New York.
People moving out. Of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, man, hey, you let me.
All of you black folks, you must go.
For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry. While the mainstream media normalizes Donald Trump's transition to power, what we've already seen is more than cause for alarm. Jeff Sessions for Attorney General and Trump pick white nationalists can love. General Michael Flynn for National Security Advisor. He says fear of Muslims is irrational. And Steve Bannon as Chief Strategist and White House Counselor gets a thumbs up from the KKK. This is a time to organize and stand for what is just, a time to stand against hate and bigotry, and a time to stand together, a time to support your listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station. Please go to give2wbai.org. Go there now, give2wbai.org, and become a WBAI buddy. And thank you.
Hi, this is Chloe Glickman, and I'm an intern at WBAI. Looking to get professional experience doing something you're actually passionate about? At WBAI, I'm able to develop skills in journalism, marketing, event planning, editing, social networking, and much more, all while working directly with producers and the management team. BAI is always taking applications for credit and non-credit internships, so get in touch today. Send an email to internships@wbai.org for more information. Join the team that supplied New York with independent radio for over 50 years. Help keep community radio going strong.
When you think of the golden age of radio, you're bound to remember the performer whose hold on the heartstrings of America spanned almost three generations.
Well, thank you, Jack. Yes, it's Max Schmid, and I'm your host for the Golden Age of Radio. Sunday nights at 7 p.m. here on WBAI, presenting the finest in radio's history, comedy, drama, mysteries, science fiction. Won't you join me Sunday nights at 7 for the Golden Age of Radio? Only here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
I hope you feel that way.
Power! Power! Stand up! Stand up! Power!
Okay, we're back. I guess I have to also continue to remember that we are doing this show in collaboration with ycradio.org. I don't know if they're off today or not. Maybe they're not. We hope they are running today. But these shows, Vantage Point, is also exposed to the York College community, if you will. And we often reach in and tap some of them as well to be guests on the show. A nice collaboration. I really like that. Well, today's show, again, with a focus on Haiti. And let me just say, I have an article up. I hope it's on the website by now. It certainly will be soon, which focuses on the election. As Judge Lionel Joan Baptiste was talking about, it calls for a government of national inclusion. And I think it says Preval showed the way. President Preval showed the way, because I happen to think that President Preval's administration is illustrative of how Haiti ought to move in these times. And essentially what I'm arguing for is, if the elections were legitimate, and by all signs they were, and there's a way in which this very young democracy that Haiti has, we have to be patient with. People have to have structures that they can trust and they believe in. And at some point we have to get out of the habit of just, you know, contesting the results, particularly if the results can be verified in a way that is universally seen as reasonable. But then I also believe that by definition, you have to have a government of national inclusion. This idea, this winner-take-all system that we have in the United States is not a good thing. You need to bring people in who have different points of view, who are from the opposition. So you share resources, you share ideas, and put the nation first, Haiti first, not the self-aggrandizing ambitions of the political class. Among that class must come some who will sacrifice this tendency towards, as Gabriel would say, this tendency towards becoming the bourgeoisie, or you ain't really going to be the bourgeoisie, but some pale shadow of same, to put the nation first. And, you know, it's just an article. It may not go very far, but it's out there. The second article that's also on the website has to do with the election. And it's called, what did I call that now? Trump will be, Elections Matter. The article's entitled Elections Matter. That's really the subcaption. Trump will be like Reagan on steroids. And it's a fairly lengthy essay, but I go point by point to make some of the points that I tried to make here on this show and others prior to the election. It's quite interesting now that people are alarmed. They've got Trump, got all these things going on now. Well, I sort of said, be careful in terms of how we look at elections, each of which has to be analyzed within the context of the circumstances and the particularities of our time. So that essay is entitled Elections Matter. Trump will be Reagan on steroids. And I use those words advisedly. And I think as you read the article, hopefully you'll come to understand what it is that I was trying to say. Also, we want to continue to push the idea of having WBAI buddies, which allows us to have the debate and the discussions that we're having, and these kind of shows that are out here today. So go to give2wbai.org and become a WBAI buddy. Also, more information on the womensmarch.com. I think this is going to be an important march. And I think that now that people like Tamika Mallory and others are engaged in making sure the centrality of African Americans and people, other people of color, I think it will be important that people support it, become involved in it. This does not distract from our need to organize our own particular organizations, which I also think is important. It's always important to have your black base, your brown base, your red base, your whatever the people of color ethnicities and nationalities are. Those bases need to be strong, but we also need to then find ways to coalesce respectfully and build these united fronts to advance a vision of change, even as we oppose the kind of ridiculous but dangerous things that are going to happen as a result of the election through a flawed process of Donald Trump. So let's go to our listening audience now. Others can call at 347-335-0818. If you don't get on immediately, just be patient. We'll get you in. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Daniels. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
New Year.
Same
thing. Listen, it seems from my observation that Donald Trump, like you just said, will be Reagan on steroids, basically doesn't understand how to govern, will basically do things to tear apart this country that I believe will be unimaginable. The only thing that will save us as Americans will probably be if what happened to John Kennedy may happen to him. And I think there's a possibility that it will be if he does certain things that is not in the best interest of the powers of be. Now, my concern as an African in America is we as a people really have no plan. We are talking about going out here on the 14th and marching. For what reason, I don't know, because I don't think marching and those type of things will affect Trump at all. I think that he's oblivious to that type of action. I'm just looking myself for so-called black leadership to come up with some new type of plan to address the problems that we are going to face. I mean, it just doesn't seem like anything is really being prepared. There's no real true form of action being put in place to address this animal, this character who tweets and makes silly comments, who has no vision or anything in a sense of a response from our people. I mean, what is marching honestly going to do other than make that community richer, make your feet hurt, and get no real possible reply from those that are oppressing you? I mean, we have to figure out something else to do that will gain their attention. And that's been our problem for the last 30, 40 years.
Okay, well, let me appreciate your call, and I'll try to get a response to it, okay? Because I want to make way for the next caller as well. But in the interim, let me just say that I agree that we're going to have to find some innovative, creative ways of resistance in this period, that marching in and of itself and by itself will not be the solution. However, marching is important in that it shows people that we're not apathetic, that we are willing to resist. I happen to think that that's why the Women's March is also going to be powerful. My sense is that it'll be huge. And women were insulted. Unfortunately, the majority of white women who voted, and I have to keep saying who voted, because the biggest political party in America today is not the Republicans, it's not the Democrats, it's non-voters. 100 million people did not vote in this last election. So I have to keep stressing, of those who voted, most white women voted white over their interest, in the sense, well, people might say whiteness was their interest, because the insults, the degradation, the humiliation, none of that seemed to matter, at least to this majority who voted for Donald Trump. Black women overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton. They voted in a way that they felt reflected their best interest, as best they, given what they saw as the realistic choices out there. But now we have this result. And as I lay out in my article, that, you know, point by point by point, it is potentially devastating in terms of the culture of rights that so many people have fought for all these many years, and that, quite frankly, many people kind of said, oh, ho-hum, it doesn't matter, you know, the choices are all the same and all that. And I said, no. I laid out why I think it was important to make certain critical choices. Having said that, I think civil disobedience in mass form is one of the things that can happen. I think using the economic lever, particularly in the black community, but also showing others. I mean, we've seen how backward retrograde governments, even in North Carolina and Indiana, you know, who have passed these bills that are clearly discriminatory towards gay and lesbian people or LGBT people in general, how they backed up when there's a threat of economic sanctions. So economic sanctions is a tool that we're going to have to use. So, yes, we're going to have to be creative. But among other things, in this 2018 election, I do declare we're going to have to march on ballot boxes. I don't care what the voter suppression are. We're going to have to overwhelm the system by using that tool. It's not the only tool, but it's one of them that we have to use to begin to make a dent. And it has to happen at the local level first. And I must say that in the black community, we are in our own way, because sometimes we have elected officials who really aren't that encouraging of the kind of participation, because it may not be for them individually. Got to put individual interests behind. Collective interest is what matters. And we got to surface people. And I hope they come out of the Black Lives Matter movement. I hope they come out of the gathering that Tamika Mallory was talking about. These visionary, courageous young people. And I must say that Charles and Inez Barron, for me, represent the kind of elected officials. They're not the only ones, but they are the epitome of the kind of elected officials that have to emerge who are prepared to be revolutionaries in office, who understand the limitations of it, and yet know that not engaging in it surrenders the field to the opposition to make policy that also hurts us. And so we need to study them and their organization and power that they're pulling together, because that's the route that we're going to have to take. So again, others can call at 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. I don't know if we have another caller yet or not, but the phone line are open for just really only a couple more minutes, actually, in order for you to get into the conversation. Again, WBAI buddies are important to the foundation of this city. Please support that. Again, I wanted to just say I am finally getting a little breather to write a few more articles. I'm going to write a three-part series on the election. The one entitled Elections Matter, Trump Will Be Reagan on Steroids, is the first essay. There are two more that are coming. And, of course, I also have this essay out now on Haitian Independence Day, which was yesterday, but also talking about the electoral situation in Haiti and calling for a government of national inclusion, if you will. So you can go to the website ibw21.org to review those articles. And while you're there, sign up to get the newsletter, sign up to get information. The Declaration of Intent and Call to Action from the conference is there. We're going to be talking about that a lot, because it's not over. It's about continuous organizing. And we thank those who have been kind enough to respond to our appeal for support. We need much more of that, just as WBAI is making the response and appeal for WBAI buddies. We have something called the Gregory Griffin Circle of Sustaining Supporters, and we've been eager to get them involved in order to enhance the base of IBW to be strong enough to survive as an organization and do the good work that needs to be done. I think we have one more caller on the line. Got about maybe 2 minutes to get another caller in. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning, Dr. Daniels. Happy New Year, or a brand new day. We'll go there.
Okay.
Dr. Daniels, I have always proposed over a very long period of time that this reactionary attitude is proper for those who understand it. But I also thought that we should never be spending our dollars at all. When we can create our own food conglomerate, we can have people to, back in the 60s, we had what we called, we had many names. One of them was our Family Protection Association, wherein we gathered our children together in different settings to teach civics, because there was civics in schools in the 60s and early 70s. I believe that the economic boycott piece is the only way to go. We can begin to barter and do different things to never spend our dollars at Macy's or at any of the other major conglomerates, when we can buy directly from the Chinese ourselves, buy directly from the Japanese ourselves. And all of these different cultural aspects, we can buy supplies to supply them. And I'll hang up and listen to your commentary.
Well, that's a good point. We'll be able to talk about that. However, we've just run out of time. That music in the background means that we got to get out of the way for the next show. But we certainly have appreciated you tuning in to this Haitian Independence edition of Vantage Point and the first show of 2017. There'll be more to come. Don't forget to go to the website ibw21.org to get those articles I referred to you, as well as let's go to womensmarch.com to make that Women's March. Well, there are other marches, but when women hit the streets, they've been oppressed for many, many years, marginalized and so forth. Their voices need to be heard. And as Tamika Mallory pointed out, the voice of black women and women of color will be central. So go to the website, womensmarch.com, and get that information. We'll see you next week here on Vantage Point.
Hi, this is Jesse Eisenberg. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org.
Say it loud, say it clear. Refugees are welcome here.
Immigrants, workers, people of color, white workers who made the mistake of voting for him. We're going to form the kind of coalition that is going to change this country.
Hector Figueroa, president of 32BJ, SEIU. WBAI stands with Figueroa and all people standing against racism, against hate, xenophobia, misogyny.
We don't want to be fighting over which chair we're going to be sitting on the Titanic. We need to find a different boat. Maybe we'll have more than one vote. Maybe we'll keep the name. But certainly the politics of the Democratic Party, as it has been up until today, have failed us at least in 2010 and, quite frankly, over the last 25 years.
And that's why a listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station right in the center of the FM dial is needed. Stand with us. Become a listener sponsor of WBAI. Go to give2wbai.org. And thank you.
This is the theme music for Cat Radio Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
A salon of the arts.
Uh-huh.
Mondays at 2 p.m. I'm Janet Coleman, the host.
And I'm David Dozer.
The displaced playwright.
Announcing
Cat Radio Cafe.
Cat Radio Cafe, featuring great interviews with scintillating authors and provocative artistes.
Or vice versa.
I see you, cats.
Hey.
Stop clawing the furniture. Head for the radio.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Mondays at 2 p.m. here on WBAI.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
If it's brewed with fish.
Come on, neighbors, let's get wise.
So, the plaster is falling, the paint is peeling, the plumbing is leaking, the heat and hot water keep cutting off, the elevator keeps breaking down, and the landlord won't return your calls, but the rent keeps going up and up and up.
Find out what you can do about it. Tune in to Housing Notebook, Mondays at 8 p.m.
Reactionary landlord.
People are already comparing the upcoming Trump era to the 50s McCarthy era. On the next episode of Ken Gayle's Ecologic will be a discussion with people who were there. The 50s had the communist blacklist and attack on unions, but it also had Ban the Bomb and civil rights marches and the flourishing of political folk music. Join Corinne Willinger of the Raging Grannies, Viney Burroughs of the Granny Peace Brigade, and other elders who lived through the McCarthy era. Tuesday, January 3rd at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it, and I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.